Right, now this is talk 12 in the series on the wicked, and we're picking up on the subject of dealing with deception and deceivers, and so we're just carrying on with that theme that we had started already. So another point to make is this: it's important to seek God's help to discern when you're being lied to. And again, that may sound like an obvious thing to do, but have you ever asked yourself, when have you ever actually asked God to help you to know whether you're being lied to? And if so, where, how, and by whom? Have you ever actually asked that? Most of us never make any such prayer or request. And until about, say, 10 years ago, I didn't either. It never occurred to me, really, that I needed to say that or ask that. But actually, I've come to realise that it's absolutely essential. And not only is it essential, it's utterly obvious that you should be doing that. Just as obvious as lots of other things are obvious, but that we don't do them. So why not try doing that? Ask God to open your eyes to see, to expose any lies of which you're currently unaware, and to prevent you being deceived by people who are liars, because they are all around us. It's not, as I keep stressing, some exceptionally strange thing that might happen 20 years from now, then it might happen again 20 years after that. It's happening all the time. People are all around us. And so, in Psalm 120, verse 2, it says, "Deliver me, O Lord, from lying lips, from a deceitful tongue." So the psalmist is aware that liars are all around, and he considers it a right and proper subject to talk to God about. And why on earth would it not be? If it's right and proper to talk to God about all your other problems, why not talk about this, given that it's such a big problem? So let me give an example of how God exposed a liar to me, and it was the direct answer to a prayer. And I was baffled some years ago because a number of things just didn't add up when I was running my law firm. Certain things just didn't make sense, and I was confused as to what was going on in the office. And I sensed that somebody somewhere was deceiving me about something and being disloyal or unhelpful in some way. But of course, it's in the nature of deception that it's covert. People don't come up and say, "I'm just about to deceive you now, so just listen to this now as I'm just about to lie to you." And if they did, it would be helpful, but most of them don't. And so that's in the very nature of this, that it's covert, it's intended to be covert. And so I sensed that something somewhere was confusing to me. Some things didn't fit, the jigsaw didn't fit together. And often if you come across that, if you feel that, it's very likely that somebody somewhere is lying to you about something, which you're then treating as fact, but it isn't fact. And so one of the pieces of your jigsaw, you've accepted it as a valid piece of the jigsaw, but it's from another jigsaw. It's the wrong piece, and it doesn't fit into your situation. And often it's because you've believed something that's a lie, and you're acting as if it was true, but you don't know that it's a lie, and it's often the case. And so this was what I felt one day, and I just asked God, and I just asked him, what is the source of all this? Is somebody somewhere deceiving me? If so, who is it? Please help me to see what's really going on. That's broadly what I asked God to do. And to my amazement, I didn't really expect this, but God answered me immediately. And I heard in my head an almost audible voice saying a person's name. And it was the name of a senior member of staff. And I would never have dreamed that that person would be deceiving me. It just seemed unthinkable. I'd never even considered it as a possibility. And I therefore never asked myself whether that person was trustworthy. And the very fact that it was so unthinkable meant that I'd never thought about it. I never asked about it, never sought for guidance about that. And at first, when I heard this, I was reluctant to believe that what I'd heard could even be true, let alone be a warning. But I then began to check it all out extremely carefully. I should emphasise this, I didn't act on it. So if ever God speaks to you in this way, you need to still check it out. You don't just act upon something because you hear something like this. It very rarely happens to me. It happens just a few times. On each occasion, you know, some really important thing has been revealed to me. But on this occasion, something very important was revealed to me. But I still didn't act upon it, except in this sense. I began to check it out really thoroughly. I checked it out. And as I did, all sorts of other things were discovered, and I found all sorts of irregularities and things I just had not seen. Can you imagine that? If you don't, you know, it's like the other day we went walking in London, and I've been through London in taxis and so forth, and all sorts of stuff just passes you by. But we went on a walking tour with a tour guide, who took us down little streets and alleyways and across this little street and across little bridge, and standing outside this house where such a thing happened, and then this house, and then you look up and you see a plaque, and then you see this and you see that, and you discover things when you start looking. You notice things when you start looking. But I could have gone up and down that road in a taxi, wouldn't see any blue plaques or anything at all. You know, you don't spot anything when you're just whizzing by, as most of us are doing in life, just whizzing along, not looking. But as I began to look, I found various things about this person that I hadn't spotted before. And anyway, I built up a stockpile of information until the point was reached where I thought, I think this is for real. This person has been acting wrongly. And I later then confronted that person. And when I did, they immediately asked if they could just resign rather than be interviewed. And I don't think being in my presence for half an hour is that bad. But this is what the person did. But it wasn't because they didn't want to just be in a room with me for half an hour. I think it was because they knew they'd been rumbled. And that panic reaction in itself spoke volumes to me. They knew the game was up, that I'd opened my eyes at last. But see, the point is this, the wicked know that your eyes are closed. They know you don't know. And they also know when your eyes have opened. I've had this experience so many times. You just have to walk in a room and the wicked know, oh, you've seen through me. They can tell just from your face and the way you look at them. They know you've seen through them. They know something's happened and that you've rumbled them. And this person knew they had been rumbled, and they knew it was pointless being interviewed by me, because once my eyes are opened and I start to interrogate somebody and investigate something, I'm more or less like I'm unstoppable. Once I get started, my problem is not knowing what on earth's going on. But once the deceiver is exposed, then they are, you know, they're done for once they've been exposed. That's the whole point, you see. You need to realize this. The deceiver operates by being hidden. Once they're exposed, it's like as if someone's pulled the towel away. They're just standing there with nothing on. You know, once they're exposed, they're powerless. They can't do anything anymore. And this person knew that if I interviewed them, it would all come out. And they just asked if they could just resign immediately and go. And that's just for being, you know, for me inviting them to come to be interviewed about an investigation I wanted to carry out, about some concerns I had about their conduct and their behaviour and what they've been saying and doing. So, the moral of the story really is, make it your regular practice to ask God to reveal any deception or treachery or disloyalty to you. That's not paranoia. It's just sheer common sense. Paranoia is believing that people all around you are all out to get you. Asking God for protection from the deceivers and the lies and the liars that tell them is not paranoia. It's straightforward common sense, where you know that somebody out there is lying. There are bound to be liars out there. I want God to reveal them to me and help me to be protected from them. Some of the information I get each day is bound to be lies, and you're asking God to show you which of it is lies and which of it is true. and that is straightforward common sense and has nothing to do with being cynical or paranoid. So make it your regular practice. And I stress it because, in my experience, hardly anybody ever does that. And if you don't do that, what are you effectively doing? You're saying, I'm going to rely entirely on myself to figure it all out for myself, all by my very own self. Well, what kind of a nitwit would say that about any part of life? I wouldn't trust myself to do anything all by my very own self. I would ask God's help with everything. It's much more sensible, and especially with something at this level of difficulty. It's not wise to rely solely on yourself or on your own investigations, even assuming that you're making any, which you probably aren't. Because if you're daft enough not to ask God's help, you're probably too daft to notice there's a problem to be investigated in the first place. So, ask it. Ask God to help you with it. And if you can't learn to detect lies, this is important. If you can't learn to detect them, find them, you will inevitably end up surrounded by liars without knowing it. And if so, you may also find that evil is done in your name by people whom you misguidedly trust, especially if you're a supervisor, a manager, a boss, a leader of any kind. If you can't detect it, things will be done that you're not aware of, even done in your name. Having said that, most of us are not in senior positions in businesses or churches, but many of us, a lot of us, do have some kind of junior or intermediate managerial responsibilities. And we may be asked to look after some project or task or group or manage some people, however small or few they may be. And if you don't learn how to identify and tackle liars, you will end up surrounded by them, whether you realize it or not. And also, the more unaware we are of them, the more we'll believe them. And the proportion of liars in your life will increase, partly because you're not weeding them out, and partly because they'll come looking for you, wanting to work for you, wanting to be with you. If they know that you're incapable of discerning your way out of a moist paper bag, if they figure that out, which they will be able to figure out, they know who's shrewd and who's not. And that kind of person wants to be around you, and they'll multiply. Their friends will come in and join them if you aren't weeding them out and identifying them. It says in Proverbs 29:12, if a ruler listens to falsehood, all his officials will be wicked. So you might feel squeamish about being on your guard against deceivers, or you might think it's judgmental to think of people in those ways, but you actually owe it to other people who work under you or who work alongside you. We're not just talking to bosses, I keep stressing this. You also have a duty to those who work alongside you. Indeed, you also have a duty to those who are higher than you, at work or wherever, or in church. You owe them all a duty not to be naive. So this need to not be naive is not something purely and solely for your own benefit. It's also for their benefits, for the benefit of everyone around you. Because otherwise, if you stay naive, if you can't find lies and identify liars, you'll make it easy for manipulators and also for bullies to take over that organization and to harm the other people, not just you. So it's not just the harm will be done to you. We need to stop being quite so egocentric about everything in life. The whole world is not about you. So confronting the wicked, exposing liars, is not just about you and what it does to you or prevents for you. It's about what it does for others and prevents for others. You're kind of part of the neighborhood watch, as they say. You know, you're meant to be looking out for others, not just for yourself. So you don't only confront the wicked for yourself and for your own sake, but for the people around you. So let me make another new point. And it's this: don't be put off when people emphatically deny things, even when their denials sound very convincing and are very passionately expressed. It's entirely normal for people to speak that way, to emphatically deny something. And it does not mean that you've got it wrong. And so this is important, because if you don't realise this, it can cause you to doubt yourself and to doubt your own evidence, even when you've got strong evidence, merely because someone's emphatically denying what you're putting to them or asking them about. And they can look you straight in the eye. They can even become tearful and plead with you to believe that they're innocent. Now, of course, they could be innocent. They could be. But the mere fact that they say so is no reason for thinking that they are. Whether a person is innocent or not is something that needs to be ascertained by reference to facts and figures and investigation, not simply because they say so. Do you see? And so, if you're a sincere person yourself, this is one of the problems. If you're sincere, it's this problem of imputing to others whatever you are. It applies to everybody, the wicked and the naive and simple and the virtuous. We all tend to impute to others whatever we are ourselves. That means we think they are what we are. And so it's hard to imagine, therefore, how someone could be so emphatic in their denial if they were actually guilty. Because you're thinking, well, if it was me and someone asked me if it was me that had done this or if I'd done that, I couldn't stand there and just deny it to everyone. I would say, yes, it was me. But that is to foolishly impute to them your own standard. They don't think that way. And that's not how they act. So you have to try to come to terms with the fact that barefaced denial is completely normal, even when the person is guilty. So occasionally it's worth asking someone if they've done it, but you can't, and of course if they say they have, that's fair enough. But if they say they haven't, that's not fair enough. The investigation doesn't end there. Otherwise police interviews would be pretty brief. Wouldn't, have you done it? No. Oh, fair enough then. Interview concluded. That's not how it happens. That's not the way you do it. So therefore expect denials and never be diverted from your purpose merely because the person is denying what you put to them. Of course you can bear their denial in mind. Of course it's a relevant factor to think about. But you can't do any more than that until you investigate matters to find out whether their denial is credible. So it cannot be treated as such merely because they say so. Because the point is this, the person's credibility is the very thing that you're seeking to gauge. So to take their word for it is to put the cart before the horse, because you're taking the word of a person about whom you're conducting an inquiry to find out whether you can take their word. Do you see the point? So you're assuming that you can take their word on the question of whether you can take their word for it. That's not the way to do it. You can't form any conclusion based on what they say if they're denying it, just solely on their denial. It has to be based on other factors. And it basically has to be based on an assessment of the whole overall evidence, which will include all other factors that are available. Witnesses, circumstantial evidence, and the presence or absence of inconsistencies. But the denial in itself tells you nothing conclusive. Unless, of course, they're admitting it. But even then, you know, even an admission doesn't always mean they've done it. I can remember being in a police interview with this lad. He was very inadequate. And I'd roped him in on something. He was at the edges of something that had happened. And I brought him in for interview at the police station. And he admitted it all to me. But I knew he hadn't done it. And I sensed he hadn't done it. So I began this rather peculiar inverted investigation in which I sought to prove to him that he hadn't done it. So I questioned him closely, and the questions that his answers demonstrated that he had not done it. And I said to him, you've not done this, have you? And he admitted that he hadn't done it. And then and I said to him, well, why are you admitting this thing? Why are you doing this? And to cut a long story short, the reason was he was just basically seriously inadequate, personally inadequate, as many people who are in police cells are. Just very unfortunate, inadequate people. So that's an exceptional situation, but the broad thrust of what I'm saying is you don't rely on someone's denial in itself. It's not conclusive. It means you need to look into the wider facts more thoroughly in order to be able to form a view. So don't be bewildered by it. I stress that because I've been bewildered by it many a time. You know, I see evidence, the carbon monoxide detector is bleeping. There's this problem and that problem. I see this factor and that factor and this piece of evidence, but the person totally denies it. And I'd go away thinking, that's puzzling. It's not puzzling. It just means they're denying it. And what you've got to do is to continue to investigate it until you get to the heart of the matter. So don't let it deter you. Don't let that alone deter you from investigating. And above all, don't let it cause you to doubt yourself or your own instincts or your own judgment. Because many of us, we invalidate ourselves and we invalidate our own God-given judgment and discernment. And the very thing we're seeking to do is to develop discernment. And that which God has given us already is being invalidated and assumed not to be functioning properly, such that we can't rely on it. And you're relying, in a sense, more on the other person's word than you are on your own judgment. And that's not good. That's not wise at all. And so continue to weigh everything calmly and thoroughly and just keep going. That doesn't mean you form a conclusion that they have done it. Absolutely not. Why on earth would you do that? That'd be even more foolish. It's just that you don't form a conclusion. You keep going until you have a basis for forming a conclusion. All I mean is, you don't call off the inquiries because the person denies it. Let's make a separate point now. This is it. The mere fact that somebody has apologized for something does not mean that you can't then take their misconduct or their situation, what they did, into account when assessing their character or deciding how to deal with them. Does that make sense? Let's imagine a situation, someone's apologized and you're trying to weigh that person up, but in the context of all this, they've apologized for whatever it was. Can you take that situation into account when deciding what sort of person they are and whether they can be trusted, etc.? And the answer is, you take it all into account. So of course, in the right circumstances, if a person is sincere, then an apology is obviously a good thing. Of course it is. Who could say it's not? Of course it's a good thing. But apologies can also be used to throw you off course, to confuse you, and to cause you to lower your guard. And people should obviously apologize for wrong things they've done. But the mere fact that someone has done so does not mean that you cannot then take that event or that piece of misconduct into account. You still have to bear it in mind when assessing their credibility or their suitability to do a particular task or to have a particular role or whether you can trust them. And I'm reminded of this couple whom I give the name Philip and Sonia. I speak about them in various other chapters in book 6. And I was once in a situation where we needed to decide whether or not Philip and Sonia could be trusted. And together with two other couples in that particular church, we drew up a long list of things that Philip and Sonia had said and done which we felt were wrong or unacceptable. We were trying to get to the grips with the gravity of the overall problem of their misbehaviour and misconduct and wrong attitudes. So we drafted this list of factors, incidents, events, problems, concerns with these two other couples. And later we met with Philip and Sonia and told them of our concerns. And ultimately we said we were going to leave that church and start a new church, partly because of our misgivings about them. So we went through some of our concerns about their misconduct. And this is the operative point. At one stage in that discussion, Sonia piped up and she said, "But we've apologised for that." Now, we were speaking of something we were concerned about, which we felt provided a compelling basis for us to leave that church and just go and start again. by virtue of her and her husband's behaviour. Now, in her mind, the fact that she had apologised meant that we were not entitled to place any reliance upon those incidents anymore when deciding what to make of her and Philip. She felt we were obliged to forget all about those events and not take them into account when trying to form a view about their credibility or trustworthiness. Now, let's just get this clear in our theology. It's true that when sins are repented of and forgiven, God removes them from us as far as the east is from the west. Of course he does. He says he does. However, the fact that God does that does not mean that you have got to disregard those incidents or those actions or those sins when forming a judgment of that person. Can you see? Are you aware that you and God are not the same person? Do you all know that? Now the thing is, God has forgiven the person. Of course he has. And that means something incredibly important. But the fact that he's forgiven them and taken away his need to have carry out his wrath upon them, the fact that he has done that thing does not mean that you have to just be blinded from then on to the behaviour and ethical standards of that person, including what they've done in the past. Underline these words: when you are deciding whether they can be trusted. Do you see the point? You're not trying to gauge whether God has forgiven them. That's another matter. You're not trying to gauge whether they'll be subject to God's wrath at any stage. That's not the question. The question is whether you, underline the word you, can trust them. And many people get this very confused, as Sonia was doing. Having said that, I don't think Sonia was confused. Sonia was hoping that we would be confused. I don't think Sonia was confused. She was hoping to rely upon our naivety in order to cause us to wrongly and foolishly choose not to take these factors into account. So that's what she was purporting to believe, that we should not place any reliance upon those events, that we should just forget all about it. And that's just foolishness. It's wrong theology. And, you've got to, in your theology, my advice is, start to realise that God is God and you are not God. This is God over here, this is you over here. Different people. And he has his way of seeing things, and there are various purposes and meanings and significances to the way he's doing things. But you're over here and you've got a different task. And in this particular regard, your task is to work out whether the person can be trusted. Can you make them a house group leader? Can you trust them to drive the church minibus? Are they a safe driver? And on it goes. So, in regard to that, that has nothing at all to do with whether God has forgiven them. And it has nothing to do with whether they've apologized for what they did. You see? An apology is a good thing, but it doesn't change anything in this regard. Okay. Because, of course, those other points are unrelated concepts. They have no bearing on the evidential value of the events in question, or on your decisions as to what to do about the person or their conduct. You see? So, you still may have to prosecute a man, even though he's repented. If you were a policeman, the fact that he's repented and God is now considering him to have all the righteousness of Jesus Christ transferred to him, what am I supposed to do? Stop the prosecution? No, the prosecution continues because his behaviour needs to be responded to, evaluated and dealt with. It still needs to be dealt with. Now, you're not a constable, you're not prosecuting people, but you may still be a church leader, a house group leader, a youth group leader, or you may just be a supervisor at work. You might be just a colleague at work. You're just deciding whether you can trust this colleague, so these principles are applicable to all of us, irrespective of what our roles or levels of responsibility might be. Keep stressing that, because I'm picking up some vibe from some occasionally I pick up the vibes that people think all this is very applicable if you're, you know, a boss or a prime minister or something, but not, of course, if you're a shop assistant or a nurse or a dental nurse or some kind of person who works in a warehouse. Of course, not relevant to me. No, absolutely relevant to you, whatever job you're doing, whatever level you're at, in the church or at work. So, another point. Beware of people who do or say showy, pretentious things, even when those seem to be good things. So, in particular, public apologies or displays of repentance may not be real. And the more showy, the more pretentious, the more public a thing is, the more I'd be wary of it. So be very wary of a person whose apologies are showy or pretentious. Manipulators know that an apology can be very disarming, and it can be a useful device in getting other people to lower their guard, because the apology can imply that the one making the apology must be a sincere, godly person who can be trusted. Now, bring Philip and Sonia back into it. That tactic was repeatedly used by them. It was one of the things that alerted me to them, because I saw over a period of time that both of them had a tendency to make these regular public apologies in front of the church, in the most noticeable way possible. You know, they'd sort of want to announce to the whole church that they needed to apologise for such and such, some wrong attitude, some behaviour of theirs. Now, of course, making a public apology in itself is not wrong. How on earth could it be? It's a perfectly good thing if it's done sincerely, and if it's done on a one-off basis. But it's not meant to be happening all the time. So if it keeps on happening, and if the things being apologised for seem to be trivial, irrelevant, or even invented, and sometimes I think they were invented, then you should be alarmed, because pretentiousness is sinister, and it should put you even more on your guard. Okay. So I noticed this happening repeatedly with Philip and Sonia, and I concluded that it was a mixture of exhibitionism. And that was part of it, because some people just love to be the centre of attention, even in ways that make them look stupid or ridiculous. They just love being at the centre and people looking at them. That's one of the things. Some people like it, but more importantly, I think it was this: it was an attempt to convey a false impression of being spiritual, because some people want to look spiritual or look something or other. It's not just spiritual. Some people want to look clever, some people want to look handsome, some people want to look like they're very generous, some people want to look as if they're very spiritual, or you name it, something or other. The person wants to look as if they were it. But the point is that genuinely mature, spiritual, godly people don't try to convey any image or impression of anything. They are just themselves. A good person is just himself. He's not making any effort to look like anything. And so, anybody who's trying to project any kind of image of any kind, not just spiritual, but you name it, clever, generous, godly, whatever, you name it, friendly, any kind of image, or to pretend to be something and look like something, or to have certain characteristics, anyone who's trying to project an image is phony, because genuine people don't try to project an image. You just are yourself, you see. And so it's a reliable general rule that where you see any kind of pretentiousness or exhibitionism, you'll probably also find wickedness of other kinds. So a showy person will, as with any other feature or aspect of wickedness, a showy person will never only possess that one fault. They will also be false and untrustworthy in other ways as well. So, as with all these other things, wherever you see such behaviour, or a particular kind of behaviour, whatever it might be, in this case we're talking about showiness and pretentiousness, where you see that, take note and be on the lookout for other forms of wickedness within the same person. So moving on, another point. Beware of people who are sugary sweet. And if it feels excessive, then it's probably an act. And if so, then that again is a sign of something sinister. So being sugary sweet is not a good thing. It's a sinister thing. Beware of it. All the people I've ever known who were sickly sweet have turned out to be false. Of course, you need to tell the difference, learn how to tell the difference between merely being sweet and being sickly sweet. It requires discernment to tell the difference. But where we need to begin with is recognizing, at least as a concept, that there is such a thing as being genuinely sweet and such a thing as being fake and what I call sickly sweet. The one is good, the other is not good. And it's a valuable first step in discernment to recognize that there is such a thing as being sickly sweet, and to recognize that such a thing is bad and that it's not the same as being sweet. A sweet person isn't trying to pretend anything. A sweet person is just genuinely sincere, transparent, and completely open and genuine and unpretentious, unselfish, just nice, kind, gentle, decent person. They're not trying to be anything, not trying to look like anything. They're just being, you see. And so it's like when a dog runs up to you with his tail wagging. He's not trying to be anything. He's not trying to get a pay rise. He might be trying to get a biscuit. He's not trying to get anything out of you. He just wants you to know that he loves you and he likes you and he's happy. He's so happy that you've come to the front door. When our dog runs to the front door, she's just really happy that someone's come to the front door. And the greeting she gives at the door is totally genuine. You see? Our dog is not trying to cultivate an image or trying to create an impression of friendliness. It's just the real thing. And some people are the real thing. And many, many people are not the real thing. So if you ever see anybody running to the front door and wagging when you come to the front door, beware. So, the thing is, nobody puts on an act of any description unless they want you to believe something false or to prevent you from seeing something true about them. Why else would you put on an act? It's either to create a false impression of the presence of some virtue or desirable quality in that person, or it's to camouflage the presence of some vice that they don't want you to see. Why else would you pretend? So the very fact that you have discerned that the person is pretending is a problem. They are a pretentious person. They're pretending. They're being sugary sweet. But you've also got to look at their motive, why they're doing it. What else does it tell me about them? So the very fact that they're presenting a false image should trouble you. But remember, a person's dishonesty or wickedness of any kind is never limited to one single standalone issue or to only one part of their lives. There'll be other problems, there'll be other falseness, other untrustworthiness, other selfishness, other deviousness elsewhere that you haven't spotted yet. You've just spotted this one particular thing at the moment, but it needs to alert you to other things. So this lady Sonia crops up quite often in book 6. By the way, if ever you want to get into one of my books and get famous, just come and be wicked and do something wicked to me, and you'll be in the sequel to book 6 before you can say Jack Robinson. So one of the things Sonia did was she would make a beeline for any visitor coming to the church and welcome them. Now, of course, that in itself is a good thing. Being welcoming, being friendly, who could be against it? Of course it's a good thing. But what I'm speaking about is this sugary sweet thing. Though if Sonia was a cup of tea, there'd be 14 spoons of sugar in it. This is the point. Now, a cup of tea should have no sugar in it. Not, well, I don't think it should. But But a cup of tea with 14 spoonfuls is over the top. That's not good. And you've got to say, why has that person got 14 spoonfuls in? Why? What's this about? It's not natural. It's not right. And so she was way over the top in terms of even just that one point I'm concentrating on. She was way over the top in all sorts of ways. But if she saw visitors coming to the church, she would go for them like a guided missile. She'd be the first one there and she'd be all over them, hogging them to herself and just keeping them. Because she wanted to connect to that person personally, and she wanted to gain control. She wanted control over the church, control over people, and that was, I think, her motivation. And so I noticed this about her. And sometimes you only see it in retrospect as you begin to look back and re-examine events, and as you begin to wonder. And in Sonia's case, other things did arise, other issues did arise, as I've mentioned. These things don't come on their own. And as I reassessed her, it seemed to me that she fell very clearly into this category of being sickly sweet. So her aim wasn't just to welcome people and be hospitable, which is a right and proper and valuable thing. There is such a thing as the gift of hospitality. Some people are just very gifted at making other people feel welcome and just they're so good with food and every other thing that just makes everyone so welcome. And that's a really great gift, provided it's genuine. As with anything, provided it's genuine. But in her case, it wasn't genuine. It was unnatural. She was trying too hard. She went way beyond what is right and proper. And she was trying to ingratiate herself with people to win them over. And we shouldn't be trying to ingratiate ourselves with people. We should just be kind and decent and friendly and courteous and polite and all these things, because we just want to relate naturally to folk. We shouldn't be trying too hard. I mean, often, in many cases in churches, it's the other way around. If you walk into a church, everyone just totally ignores you. And that's a very big problem in its own right. But the remedy to that problem is not for people to become sickly sweet. It's for all of us to become genuinely hospitable. So, the thing is, other people in the church were also welcoming and friendly to visitors, but when they spoke to visitors or to invited church or invited people along and so forth to their homes, they weren't trying too hard, they were just natural, whereas Sonia was unnatural. So they were real, but she was unreal. So the question then arises, how do we tell the difference between a person who's genuinely sweet and genuine and someone who's sickly sweet and therefore false? Now, of course, it's not easy, but there are a number of things we can bear in mind to help us to measure and assess people. And the first is that sickly sweetness, you will pick up instinctively, you'll begin to form the thought instinctively that this is over the top. Now, you might initially even feel guilty for even thinking that. You might think, well, what a kind of scoundrel I am. Here's this person being so hospitable, friendly, sweet, etc. And here's me wondering if it's over the top. But if you're thinking it's over the top, unless you yourself are a wicked person in some other way, if you're beginning to wonder that this is over the top, it probably is over the top. But it isn't easy to see immediately. And so, therefore, you have to watch closely over time. And if you do watch closely over a period of time, and that often is the answer, you know, those words, over a period of time. You can't tell things immediately. Unless, of course, you're Apostle Paul or someone. But I've never been anywhere near his level. So I take longer to reach a conclusion about things. But if you watch closely over time, you'll find that the person will go too far. And this over-the-top concept will begin to materialise and become evident. And it's like in amateur dramatics. I liken it to this. The person who's over the top, it's like someone who's an unskilled actor taking part in the local amateur dramatics production of something or other. They're an unskilled actor. And those kind of actors, when they're trying to play a role, they'll overdo it. So like they've got the role of a police inspector in something like An Inspector Calls or something, being put on by the local school or the village hall are putting it on. And the person who gets the role of the inspector is bound to end up, or is very likely to end up, being just that bit too much, too inspectorish. They're too much of an inspector. They're more of an inspector than inspectors are. So an amateur actor tends to overdo it and becomes a caricature of whatever it is he's trying to look like. And so you'll see them when they turn up, these inspectors on stage. They're always there with a long mac, and they've got this pipe, and they've got a hat usually, and they're sort of stroking their chin and saying certain inspectorish things. But a real police inspector, and I've known loads of them, not one of them had a long mac or stroked his chin or had a pipe or did any of those things. They're much more relaxed and ordinary, and they use fewer inspector-like phrases and expressions. They just behave normally in their own way. So there's every inspector I've ever known was totally different from all the other inspectors I've ever known. You know, they just all do their own thing in their own way. So it's, if you can identify with that analogy, people who are pretending to be sweet or pretending to be anything, not just sweet, if they're performing a role, as in amateur dramatics, they will tend to overdo it or overact to convey the intended impression. And if you're alert, and if you're wanting to try to be alert, you'll notice when they go too far or overdo it. So that's why it's helpful to recognise that there is such a concept as overdoing it, that there is such a concept of pretentiousness. If you're not even aware that such a thing exists, you won't be looking for it. But if you're aware that it exists, can you see how that's a major step forward in increasing the chances of your being able to see it? So the other thing is that you need to trust your instincts more. I keep saying this. Most people don't trust their instincts. They think that they must be wrong. But if your instinct is that someone's going over the top, the chances are, I underline the words chances are, I'm not saying you will be right. You've got to, of course you could be wrong. You could be wrong about anything, couldn't you? But we're not talking about whether you can have a guaranteed certainty. We're talking here about whether you should listen to your instincts, listen to your feelings, listen to your gut instinct. And I think you should. At least listen. Not act upon, not form a conclusion, but begin to watch more closely when your instinct tells you that something is odd or unreal or over the top or pretentious. Even if you can't yet put your finger on why or how. You might be scratching your head thinking, why are they doing it? It just seems over the top to me. It doesn't seem right to me. There's something odd about it. And when you feel that way, go with it in this sense. Begin to investigate. That doesn't mean you form a conclusion. Because if you formed a conclusion at that point, you'd be just as foolish for forming a conclusion, an adverse conclusion at that point, as you would be for forming a positive conclusion at that point. All you're meant to do at this point is begin to look into it. So there's another point, and that is that they can also give themselves away, the person who's putting on an act. They give themselves away in this way too, that they cannot manage to be consistent. So a person who's genuinely sweet-natured will be like that all the time, whoever they're with, whatever's happening, because it's what they really are. And they don't need to remember to keep up an act, because they aren't acting. You see? I remember once seeing this rather sad person. He was on some TV program and there was an audience participation. Anyway, this man went around pretending to be Elvis Presley. Apparently there's quite a few people that go around doing that. And he dressed up like Elvis Presley and even spoke like Elvis Presley. And it was really sad to listen to him. But then at one particular point, someone said something on the TV program in the audience to upset him. And when he got upset, he dropped the Southern American accent and he reverted into a Yorkshire accent and started giving them a piece of his mind. And the thing is, he couldn't keep it up. He couldn't keep up the Elvis impression. He lapsed out of it when he lost his temper. And that kind of thing you will find. So if the person's fault, then some event, some loss of temper will cause them to drop the act, and they'll revert back to type for a moment. And they will bare their teeth at you, you know, if only for a moment they will. And you need to be alert to these flashes, Because it's in these sometimes flashes of temper that you see the reality come out. There's the person keeping up the act, perhaps for weeks, perhaps for months. But then something happens. Something that is challenging or testing to them. And their teeth will be bared. They'll snarl at you. You know, just for a second even. And sometimes you may have seen that and noticed it and thought, that's odd. But you doubt your instinct. And you think, I must be wrong. I can't be right in thinking that this person is false. Because look, they're so nice. No, your instinct is probably right. If you're thinking that, if something inconsistent happens, you're probably right. And let me give you an example of this, involving, again, the ever-present Sonia. And this was just a minor incident, but it showed me something about her. As I was, just my eyes were opening to her. One particular day, we were clearing away chairs after a church meeting. And it was, we were meeting in a particular venue where we had to set up the chairs at the beginning and take them down again at the end. And I was doing the chairs this particular time at the end. And I came across a chair with a coat and a Bible on it. But I had to stack up all the chairs and this had just been abandoned. So what I did, I took the coat and placed it on the carpet. The carpet was clean enough. And I put the Bible on top of it, on top of the coat, and then I stacked the chair away. And as I did this, Sonia came rushing over. She picked up her coat and Bible off the carpet. And there was a flash of extreme anger on her face, especially in her eyes. It was only brief, but it was unmistakable. Very angry. And I could understand why a person might be mildly annoyed at me taking their coat off the chair and putting it on the carpet. But I couldn't see why anyone would be that angry. And to me it seemed way over the top angry. But the point was that that flash of anger was significant because it was so different from the image that Sonia was ordinarily projecting. This is the thing, there was a contradiction. There was a mismatch. So either the anger or the sugary sweetness reflected the real Sonia, because she couldn't be both. I don't think she could be both. And if a person is genuinely sweet-natured, there's a fellow I knew, his name was Don, and he was the most sweet-natured person I've ever met. And he was, to me, my ambition, I want to get like Don. And he was about 80 or so. And he was so mellow and patient and kind and just so gracious and helpful and forgiving towards people. So much forbearance in him. Unruffled. Now, of course, Don had been through some difficulties in life. He'd been at the Battle of Alamein. He was half deafened by the artillery. He was in the artillery under Montgomery at Alamein. He was half deaf. He could hear, but he had a hearing aid. And so he'd had some difficulties in his life. He'd been in some troubles and things in his life, in particular World War II. But I never saw Don lose his temper or do anything nasty or spiteful or anything. There was consistency. That's the point. And this is the thing. Where you see inconsistency, that is your cue to think, something's false here. And I saw in Sonia, well, something doesn't match here. How could someone be that angry, have that much anger on their face, when they are a cup of tea with 14 spoons of sugar in it? You see? Is this sugary tea or salty tea? And suddenly there was a strong taste of salt. What's going on here? Is this sugary tea or salty tea? And she was inconsistent. It wasn't the image she normally conveyed. And I think part of the problem was Sonia could see that I was rumbling her. And she was more angry with me than she was with anybody. And I think she knew that the writing was on the wall for Sonia in terms of her act being exposed. I was seeing through her, whereas others were not. And she could see that I was seeing through her. And she could see that others were not seeing through her. So it was I that was the threat to her. And that was what I think provoked the intensity of anger that she displayed on that day. Instantaneous anger. So the thing is, another reason why I concluded that the anger was the real Sonia, that the hatred was the real Sonia, not the sweetness, is this, that the flash of anger was instantaneous. It was just instant, you see? It burst out of her before she had any time to think. Because the point was, she'd come over and looked all just extreme anger on her face. But it only lasted about a second or two. And then she'd regained control. She'd regained her composure. And she got her coat and Bible and off she went. So I'm only judging this on a couple of seconds. Then she regained composure. Now you might say, surely you're wrong. You can't judge a person on what they do in just a couple of seconds. You need to judge them on what they do, you know, the rest of the time. I thought you were saying we need to look at the long term, measure people's fruit over the long term. We do. It's not me. I'm not contradicting myself. This is the point. You've got to measure them over a long time in order to have watched them for long enough to find out whether they're inconsistent, you see? And the whole point about being inconsistent is that they might do this 10 times in a row, but the 11th time, the mask will come off and you'll see the real them. Now when that 11th time comes and the mask comes off, that is the real Sonia. That's the real person. Not the other 10 times when the mask was on. And that's why I say you need to watch for long enough to get that 11th time. If you only watch 3 times, you won't get the 11th time. That's the point. And so the thing is, if the thing bursts out instantaneously, before they have any time to think, that shows you what's real. The flesh bursting out is the real person. That's the real them. The image that's conveyed, that's carefully cultivated and thought about, is the fake them. But what bursts out of you in a crisis is you. That's the real you. You see? What is maintained by careful cultivation the rest of the time is the fake you. That's the point. So, because people often say when things happen unexpectedly and they lose their temper, that they're acting out of character, and that's not how they really are. No, it's quite the opposite. When it bursts, whatever bursts out of a person, when they have no time to plan, no time to compose themselves, no time to put on an act, that is their real nature. And you need to have the confidence to believe that and act upon it and take it seriously. So I began to wonder much more closely why Sonia would feel such animosity, and also why she would ordinarily choose to hide it. Because, you know, she didn't ordinarily go around expressing great anger towards me. So why would she ordinarily choose to hide the anger that she felt? And the thing is that Sonia had, for once, acted in character, not out of character. It's the rest of it that was out of character. The real character was revealed by that spontaneous, instantaneous reaction. So, if someone who's ordinarily sickly sweet suddenly gives you a flash of anger or hate or says something spiteful or nasty or sarcastic, something is wrong. Or rather, something is false. And you can't afford to overlook or excuse those flashes of temper or rage, or explain them away as being out of character. They're not out of character, they're in character. So, and even in itself, such an outburst is a cause for concern. But where it occurs in the case of a person who's ordinarily sickly sweet, it's even more significant. Because it shows that not only do they have a temper problem, which would be a problem in itself if someone was just having bursts of anger. That's a temper problem, which is a flesh problem, which is a problem in itself. But if the person is sickly sweet the rest of the time, then it's an even bigger problem, because it shows you that the rest of the time they're keeping up a pretense. And that pretense is a problem in itself, quite apart from the temper that they're seeking to camouflage. So This is the thing with Sonia. She was gushing with sweetness most of the time, but if you ever crossed her, you would soon see a very, very different side to her. Now, we shouldn't have sides to us. We should just be the one thing the whole time. Just be you all the time. That doesn't mean that your personality doesn't have different interests, and, you know, when you're with this friend, you'll talk a lot about football, but when you're with this friend, you'll talk a lot about, I don't know, politics or something. That doesn't mean you're inconsistent. It just means that that friend likes football and that friend likes politics. And that's not inconsistency. I'm speaking about people whose personality is different at different times. That's the thing. And so when she... if you crossed Sonia, you'd see a very, very different Sonia than if you didn't cross her. Okay, well, let me close at that point for that talk.